In studio today, we have Cynthia Dewey-Oka from Vancouver. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello.
Could you tell us a bit about the groups you're involved with in Vancouver?
In Vancouver, currently, I work at the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. And I've been involved with the Rhizome Movement Building Center. And obviously, the Breakthrough Mamas previously, and Vancouver Status of Women.
Could you describe for us a bit more about what the purpose of Breakthrough Mamas was and some of the work that it did, including the Mother's Liberation Day and the Committee for Single Mothers on the Move that you reference in your Left Turn article that you put out recently?
Sure. So the Breakthrough Mamas actually was a collective that developed organically out of a training program. I was coordinating a training program called the Leadership Empowerment Activism Program out of Vancouver Status of Women, which is a longstanding feminist organization in Vancouver. And the program, it was basically a facilitation, sort of like activist, anti-oppression-based training program for women facing multiple systemic barriers. And I mean, I brought, obviously, a specific set of experiences into the position, and one of my main concerns was how, like, a lot of these types of programs and political leadership training, political voice development training and things like that are really inaccessible to low-income single mothers. So I made a serious effort to, like, make that happen. So the first, we ended up having a long-term sort of training program, and like I developed a child care parallel to it so that it would be accessible to low-income moms. And what ended up happening was like there were a lot of very specific concerns that came out of the group of single mothers. And I'm one of, like I'm also a single mom. It became sort of like evident that because there's been like a lack of political, theoretical development about how to work out of that space and out of that experience, that we needed something more specific. And so we did another training series that was just for low-income single moms of color. And out of that, Breakthrough Mamas came about. So, like, the women did work together. I mean, we studied organizing models, different forms of political analysis, and at the end of it, decided to form a collective to continue the work. And the work was really informed by two primary issues, which was like one, lack of representation and space for moms and kids in radical revolutionary organizing. And also what a lot of us experience is unsustainable and exclusionary methods of organizing. And then the second piece was we were concerned with multi-generationality, not just as another aspect of like identity politics, but as a way of thinking about revolutionary work generally. So like the idea of regeneration and like raising what it means to raise revolutionary communities and people. And so that's how it came about. And like one of the projects that we wanted to do was a rally on Mother's Day. There was a group of women, the grassroots women, who like organized a rally every year up until 2010, but the group was no longer together, and they weren't going to do one this year. So we thought it was an incredible sort of legacy, you know, to continue. And prior to that, we had like hosted a couple of community dialogues and to talk about, you know, to talk about these issues, and particularly around the isolation that many single moms face, and the challenges to actually getting together and doing collective work. And so, I mean, the rally really on May 7th brought together a lot of issues: housing, health, living wages, transportation, childcare, you know, migration status, law, education, culture, like all kinds of things. And the idea wasn't to be like, these are policy changes that we needed, you know. The idea was to like illuminate the ways in which moms and kids already exist in these struggles, but very often don't have space to be visible, and to have their work be respected, and that many of them are really capable thinkers and organizers and scholars and facilitators and poets, and just like have not had the space to kind of like contribute because conditions of mothering are just taken to be personal, private choices or issues that people have. The Committee for Single Mothers on the Move was like composed of the Breakthrough Mamas and Allies, which is a radical
I guess, how do you see labor as a mother as part of revolutionary work?
I think for me personally, like the two, you know, mothering and revolutionary work are not separable. They really inform each other. Sometimes because of the conditions of work of each, you know, sphere, they can be in tension with each other, but I don't think that they're actually essentially in conflict with each other. They're actually very complementary, and like the labor of like learning to value life and to strategize around like life, like a real physical person that is like with me all of the time, that I'm responsible for all of the time, you know, and having to pay attention to how I translate revolutionary values into the context of a relationship, into the context of like a person developing into, you know, kind of their own individual. I think that's one way that it's connected. Another way that it's connected is that mothering in itself, like the way that the practice of mothering also informs the way that I think about revolutionary politics, because it keeps things very grounded. It keeps things, like, it is difficult to kind of, like, lose myself in, like, ideological language, because you end up having to, like, worry about really concrete stuff all the time and juggling a lot of balls all the time. And then, of course, there's the piece that's, like, unpaid work, you know? And I think it actually forces a lot of questions that, you know, activist mamas are not at all in necessarily agreement about, but I think it's a really important debate, because like when we're thinking about capitalism as a system that we need to disrupt and transform, you know, like there are different ways that people go about it. There's like, you know, obviously struggles related to wages, to like improving our wages, and then there's also the aspect of the questions around, well, what does it mean to commodify labor and to kind of enable our investment in a system that commodifies our labor, because like when we become dependent and more dependent on wages as a way of living, then like how do we actually then divorce ourselves from it, you know? And it's like, I don't think that there's like a final answer to either or, like that one is right and another is wrong. I think they're very much in conversation with each other. Like I'm a working in the sense of, like, I have paid employment, single mom, and, like, what is that? And it's interesting to notice, you know, how do you negotiate, like, self-determination inside of that? And that for a lot of single mothers, like, paid employment is not an option. And what does that mean for livelihood? And what does that mean for figuring out how people who are mothers, who are always already working, whether or not you're in a paid employment situation, how do you make livelihood, you know? How do you actually put food on the table? Like, you know, how do you get milk for your kids? Some really concrete daily things that then inform, that can feed a much larger discussion about what does it mean to do revolutionary struggle against capitalism, for example. Does that make sense?
It does.
It's not like necessarily an answer, but I think it brings up really important questions like that.
Speaking of that unpaid labor work and the fact that mothers often have, especially if they're sort of marginalized, they often will have work on the side that they have to do that is paid work in order to afford to live. I'm really curious about the practical aspect of starting the Breakthrough Mamas and starting those initial workshops and community discussions. How exactly did you reach out to mothers in the community?
I think it is. There's a difference here in the sense that, like, when the Breakthrough Mamas were doing this, like, we were mamas. So there was, like, that access point. Because we could show up and talk to people, like, at schools, you know, and at community centers and at, like, Superstore. And we would have our kids with us. And that's already an access point in that people are like, oh, you know the reality, you know, or you know whatever. So there's that level. And I think I'm excited to hear that you guys are actually having a consultation about this because I do think that it can be difficult. There's a lot of – it's just that it's been such a historically – like activism has been like a historically, I think, difficult space for moms to access. Not to say that moms have not been central figures, you know, and active participants, but that in terms of systemically – we don't see a huge representation. And I think going to places where moms and kids are and learning to be uncomfortable and still willing to learn in those spaces are important. I think one way is like figuring out how already we can have children in our lives. A lot of you know, sort of like young, single activists coming from middle-class backgrounds with a lot of mobility and a lot of, like, sort of autonomy don't necessarily have an experience what it's like to have children or to be, to have caregiving responsibilities attached to, you know, like in a constant way. So I think one way actually is, like, supporting the people already that we know in our lives and, like, learning from that. So I think that the other way of thinking about it is, like, instead of, like, how do we get moms to access us, it's, like, how do we access them and make ourselves comfortable in sort of, like, their realities? Because I think that's important. So that because for a lot of single mothers, it's not, and for a lot of moms generally, it's, like, it's really difficult because we're, like, juggling. Like, you're working around other people's schedules all of the time. Like, not just your employer or family or government, like, depending on, you know, how you're accessing, like, some basic form of security in your life. But obviously your kids. Like, as much as people who are allies can integrate themselves into some area of our lives, it makes things a lot easier to have conversations. For example, I would go and do political work with moms who are, like, hospitalized after a birth. And that's where we would do political work, like political training, you know, in the hospital rooms. Or in somebody's kitchen while helping with, like, diaper changes and making dinner. And that's where we would have political conversations. Sometimes, like, going into those spaces instead of, like, thinking of a classic, you know, kind of meeting space somewhere, on the bus, great place. Like I said earlier, like, supermarkets, you know, like, well, shopping for groceries and stuff. And it's usually great when I have my kid with me because then, you know, like, the kids can go and hang out, you know, or, like, at playgrounds and places like that. And, yeah, so that's one way.
In your article for Left Turn, you question the nature of mass mobilization and direct action models of organizing. Coming from that, what do you see as the way we ought to be conducting ourselves to produce revolutionary change? And in that, can you identify how parents and kids ought to be integrated?
Mass mobilization, direct action model of organizing is, like, incredibly valuable. And I also do think that without a larger context of having a politics of caregiving within our communities, it can become an incredibly unsustainable mode of revolutionary practice and can actually engender a lot of reactivity. Many of us end up, you know, in that spiral of getting reactive and then feeling like, and then going into, like, individualistic kind of, like, cocoons of self-care that then detach us from our communities, which doesn't make any sense. And I know this sounds really simple and might sound cliche, but I really do think that, like, learning to caregive is, like, one of the most important things that I have ever learned as not just as a political worker, but also as a human being. Because it demands that we do things in balance, and it demands that we do things with a long view. When there is a sense of daily, constant responsibility, that's not going to sort of, like, dissipate at the end of, like, a rally or a blockade, you know? Like, there's a sense of continuity, I guess, that requires doing things in such a way so that we don't reproduce despair. I think there's a need to recognize, like, organizing as work that takes time, energy, commitment, like, skills, networking, relationships, all of these things that the vast majority of is unpaid. So for a lot of people who are caregivers and who are mothers and are not getting paid already, and already, like, having second, third, fourth shifts or whatever, I think it's important to have support systems. So I do think that developing support systems for ourselves intentionally as part of organizing is incredibly important in order to sustain revolutionary work and make change actually possible. In specific situations, like, people are going to do, you know, what's required of those specific circumstances. So I feel like I can only answer broadly in terms of, I think it's important to reclaim institutions of social reproduction. Like, very concretely, I do think that's important, that we need to fight for schools.
Where do you stand on, I guess it's more of an anarchist versus state capture question, but would you, maybe it's not even a dichotomy here, but if you were to choose, would you rather have revolutionaries at this point building their own new institutions, building their own schools, building their own caregiving spaces, or do you see a need to focus more on changing the policy of the ones that the state has control of already?
I would have to say the former. I do think that we need to be building new institutions. I don't think that the current systems are salvageable in the sense of, like, how they're run, the pedagogies behind them. Like, I don't think that's salvageable. It's rooted in, like, just inherently colonial practices and mentalities. I do think, though, that we need to not write off the resources that exist in these institutions, in the sense of, like, there are physical buildings, and become, and, like, you know, join the pack or whatever, so that you have, like, a direct say in terms of influencing the school board and, like, whatever. And at the same time, also be building, like, local independent schools that can be sort of, like, that can be, you know, in more guerrilla settings, like you do in, at the park or somebody's backyard, you know, like, it doesn't matter, where we do more radical work with our kids and parents and stuff. Like, I see them as, like, they can be in conversation with each other. Where it's difficult is, like, energy, right? Like, where, how would you prioritize, where would you do that? But I think that's a larger question of, like, the fact that because his work has been marginalized and hasn't had a lot of, like, shine, it becomes, like, a small group of people usually, and then it's like, well, what do you do with your time? And then it's like, well, it's easier to, like, run workshops, like, every week or, like, every other week or every month or, like, whatever, or just attach it to current forms of organizing. But I think it's significant. The schools are significant. They are important because that's the majority of time. That's, like one-third of our kids' days are, like, spent there. You know what I mean? So I think, for me, it's a really practical question in that I have to do a lot of colonizing anyway for my son after he comes home from school. So it also makes sense to try to get a footing and a politics of reclamation in schools so that we can free up some time to do other things also outside of it. Because that's frustrating. It is, like, really frustrating to have, like, for example, my son will spend, like, a lot of time at rallies, like, meetings, et cetera, And then he goes to school, and then he, like, learns something that's, like, really fucked up, you know, and then he comes home, and then I have to, like, have another conversation about them. That just, like, wastes a lot of time that I don't necessarily have. So I feel like it's also an important aspect of our organizing that the reality is, like, these institutions exist, and we don't have them yet.
So I just wanted to end off the interview to kind of flip the question on you, since we've so much focused on moms and kids. Is how do we integrate movement elders, the youth, between people like our age and your son's age? Because there's those two groups that you didn't talk about in your article. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts initially on how to integrate those groups.
When I'm thinking about multi-generational space, I'm really thinking multiple generations. So it's not, like, I had to focus on something in the article. So, like, up to this point. But there's never been a desire for or intention for it to stop at the point of, like, moms and kids. So in terms of multi-generational space should be, like, I don't think that we have to be in the same space all the time and part of the same organization all the time. But I do think that we need to be in work and in projects and in groups that are in conversation with each other. Like, really intentionally. I do think that it is a responsibility for, like, organizers to create spaces where, like, choice actually makes sense. Like, the choice to be present actually makes sense. If a meeting is being held at, like, 8 p.m. on a school night at a place that doesn't allow children to run around, even if we say, like, we invite parents and kids to be there, like, that doesn't make any sense, actually, for parents and kids to be there. Does that make, you know what I mean? Or if we don't actually have a system of childcare and it's basically a bunch of activists who are going to watch our kids run around, and we don't have a way of generating conversations with these kids about, you know, the issues that are on the table and the issues that are being talked about that specific evening, or whether it's issues that they're going through in their schools, that was very much a part of our work, for example, previously, like, where, I mean, we've had, like, childcare organizers, you know, work with the kids with, like, issues that they were having at their specific school, whether it's bullies or teachers who were being really messed up with them and stuff like that. And, like, so that they actually exist, not kind of, like, as an extension of their parents, but as their own people, and that their issues are connected, become connected to whatever it is that we're working on at any given point in time. So I do think that requires... I think it requires, like, a lot of flexibility, and I think it requires, like, for folks who are used to facilitating a lot of these spaces and, like, controlling how they happen, to let some of that go, because sometimes we might end up having to meet in really uncomfortable spaces, like I said, for example, somebody's kitchen, you know what I mean, like, or backyard, like, things that don't necessarily happen if we're used to having, like, a community activist space to, like, do it in. But it really doesn't work for a lot of, like, mom schedules or kid schedules or an elder who, like, is not mobile and, like, can't leave their home, for example. So, and I think autonomy for, like, specific groups only exists in the context of, like, dependence. And when we end up only consolidating with people like us, I think it makes it a lot easier for capitalism to target us. Because then they can always, like, do something specific to youth organizations that then, like, you know, other organizations serving other groups don't necessarily feel like, I mean, we'll be in solidarity with you, but at the end of the day, like, we got to look out for ourselves kind of thing. And I think that's, like, the stick, you know, that's kind of, like, the underside of identity politics, which has been incredibly important for us, like, naming specific reality. But then it also... there's this other thing that happens in that then we can become specifically targeted if we don't learn to undo those lines.